All right, welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 669 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. And in today's podcast, I am going to be talking about, I'm going to be doing a rapid review series for step two and step three. This is going to be series 140. It's amazing how many of these rapid review series have been done. Again, these things are pretty high yield. You know, you listen to them, I think you'll find them to be really helpful. So what if they give you a question about a person that is, an 89-year-old male, and you're told that for the last 2 days, his daughter says that he's been altered and that she's been coming to check in on him, you know, in the evenings. You know, he's been altered and you're told that he's lethargic. He appears very weak, appears very irritable, right? And he's just not being as responsive as he usually is. And then they ask, and they tell you that the man is bedbound and he can barely move. And then they ask you, which of the following is the most likely diagnosis? I really hope you're picking an answer choice that talks about hypernatremia, right? I really hope you're thinking about hypernatremia. That's actually pretty high yield to know for your exams. So hypernatremia, why does this person have hypernatremia? Well, the person has inadequate water intake, right? In fact, sometimes our friends at the MBMEs, instead of putting an answer choice that says hypernatremia, they may put an answer choice that says inadequate water intake, right? So it's something you want to keep at the back of your mind for exams. And another group of people that can get into that situation can also be people that are disabled, right? So people that are disabled, right? Or if, for example, another thing that can cause hypernatremia will be a person that is having like just very inappropriate excretion of water, right? So they're excreting water inappropriately, right? So say, for example, you have a person that is on diuretics, right? A person that is on certain diuretics, those things can cause hypernatremia sometimes. A person that's on lithium, remember lithium can cause a nephrogenic diabetes insipidus, right? Remember when you have diabetes insipidus, you're not responding to ADH, right? Your kidneys, nephrogenic DI. Your kidneys are not responding to antidiuretic hormones, so you're going to be dumping a lot of free water in your urine, so you're going to become hypernatremic. You're going to have a low urine osmolarity, but a high serum osmolarity, right? And just diabetes insipidus in general, right? So like, the central kind where your brain is not making ADH, right? That can also cause problems, right? So typically, remember, when people are hypernatremic, right, they're going to be lethargic, they're going to be very weak, right? They'll be irritable, right? And again, if the hypernatremia gets severe enough, the person can have seizures, right? Remember, the ends of the spectrum of the sodium disorders can both cause seizures, right? So like severe hypernatremia can cause seizures. Severe hyponatremia can also cause seizures, right? So how do we treat hypernatremia? Typically, right, you're going to restrict salt, right? And you're going to give them normal saline, right? Honestly, on your exams, if a person has hypernatremia, the thing you really should be doing is to just go ahead and give them normal saline, right? Give them normal saline pretty much until they're hemodynamically stable, right? Make them euvolemic, right? And then after that, you can give them half normal saline or you can give them half normal saline with dextrose, right? But the thing is, basically, give normal saline till vital signs stabilize. That's how you manage hypernatremia, right? Although, one thing I would say is when you're managing a person's sodium, don't be too good at your job, basically, is what I'm trying to say here, right? Don't drop their sodium by more than 12 millimolars per liter in 24 hours, right? Basically, like, you just want to think of this conversion factor like 0.5 millimoles per liter per hour, right? Because if you drop a person's sodium too quickly, right, that can cause cerebral edema, can cause seizures, can cause death. Again, the thing is, when things are done in gradual fashion, the body adjusts to it better than when things are done in very aggressive fashion, right? So, like, for example, if you start a new workout program and you go from never running before to wanting to run 5 miles in one go, then that's going to be a problem. Your body's going to be like, what in the world are you doing, right? You're going to injure something. You're going to injure a knee. You're going to injure an ankle or whatever, right? So be gradual, right? As you're going to see, this same rule pretty much happens with hyponatremia, right? So what are the classic things that will cause hyponatremia on your exams? I will say that honestly, if I'm being honest with you, hyponatremia has many causes. But one thing I've noticed is that in some way, shape, or form, they all stem from very high levels of ADH, right? Very high levels of ADH, right? So, like, for example, if you have a lot of losses, right? So let's say, you know, like the, you know, GI losses of fluid, renal losses of fluid, or you know, skin losses of fluid, a lot of blood loss, right? Again, if you think about it, you're going to make a you're not going to be perfusing your juxtaglomerular cells, right? And if you don't perfuse your GG cells, you're not going to make renin, right? And if you don't make renin, then you'll make a ton of renin. You'll make a ton of renin because you're not perfusing your GG cells well. You make a ton of renin. And as you make all that renin, right, you'll convert angiotensinogen to angiotensin 1. And then angiotensin 1 will be converted to angiotensin 2. And angiotensin 2 has multiple jobs, right? So it's a vasoconstrictor, right? That's one thing it does. But in terms of hormonal action, right, one thing it does is it goes to the zona glomerulosa of the adrenal cortex and causes you to release more aldosterone. And then it also goes to your brain and causes you to make more ADH. Now, let's ask ourselves what these two specific hormones do. What does aldosterone do? Aldosterone makes you reabsorb sodium and water, right? And then ADH makes you reabsorb free water. So if you notice, look at it as an equation. There's like one thing that helps you with sodium reabsorption, but there are two things that help you. So the one thing that helps you with sodium reabsorption is aldosterone. But there are two things that help your water reabsorption. That's aldosterone and ADH. So you're going to be bringing in more water than you're bringing in sodium. So that will dilute your serum sodium, right? So that can lead to hyponatremia, right? Also, if they give you a question about like a big long-term smoker and the person has hyponatremia, right? We know that we're dealing with SIDH. And remember, though, there's other things that can cause SIDH, right? It's not only small cell lung cancer with smoking. You can also get SIDH from drugs like carbamazepine. So they can give you a question about a person that is being treated for trigeminal neuralgia or something along those lines, right? And also remember, you can also get SIDH from like SSRIs, right? You can get it from stress. Stress can cause hyponatremia. Stress can cause a psychogenic polydipsia. This is one that usually is kind of like a what for many people on the exams, but stress can cause a lot of hyponatremia, right? Because it causes people to have psychogenic polydipsia, right? You're stressed, right? One way some people handle stress is by drinking tons of water, right? So how do you differentiate psychogenic polydipsia from something like SIDH, for example? Well, remember, in SIDH, you have too much ADH, so you're going to be sucking up a lot of free water from your urine. So urine osmolarity is going to be high, but your serum osmolarity is going to be low. Flip that up and compare that with psychogenic polydipsia. You're drinking tons of free water, right? So your serum osmolarity is going to be low, and your serum is going to be like, man, I don't like having all this water on board. So you're going to dump some of that water in the urine. So your urine osmolarity is going to be low as well, right? So for SIDH, you're going to have low serum osmolarity, high urine osmolarity. For psychogenic polydipsia, you're going to have low serum osmolarity and a low urine osmolarity, right? And then, remember, adrenal insufficiency can also cause hyponatremia, right? So if you have adrenal insufficiency for any reason and your zona glomerulosa is not working, right, you're not going to be making aldosterone, right? You're not going to be making cortisol. Remember, cortisol has an aldosterogenic effect. Again, you won't reabsorb sodium and water. That can make you hyponatremic, right? And then hypothyroidism can also cause hyponatremia. Again, many people don't think of it this way, but hypothyroidism can cause hyponatremia. And what's the mechanism there? Well, if you think about it, when you're hypothyroid, your cardiac output is going to decrease significantly, right? Because remember, one of the jobs of thyroid hormone is to cause you to insert more beta 1 receptors on the surfaces of your cardiac myocytes, right? So that your cardiac output will increase. But if your cardiac, if you're not slapping beta 1 receptors in your cardiac myocytes, your cardiac output is going to be, your heart is not going to be very responsive to catecholamines. So your cardiac output is going to be significantly down. And if it's down, then you're not going to be, again, having good forward flow. You're not perfusing your kidneys. Your GG cells are not making renin, right? So you're not making aldosterone. I don't know why I keep saying this. I keep going in the reverse, right? So your cardiac output is low. Since your cardiac output is low, you're not perfusing your kidneys. If you don't perfuse your kidneys, your GG cells will flip out. They'll make a ton of renin, right? And then you make a lot of angiotensin 1, angiotensin 2, right? And then you make a lot of aldosterone and ADH, right? And if you make all this aldosterone, you make all this ADH, that's going to cause, again, one thing reabsorbing sodium, two things reabsorbing water, that's going to cause a person to have a hyponatremia, right? Because you're reabsorbing more water than sodium, right? And again, if a person has just things that prevent forward flow, right? Like if a person has just straight up CHF as well, that can cause hyponatremia. That can cause more of a hypervolemic hyponatremia because the person is going to be volume overloaded, you know, because they're not pumping, right? They have all this increased systemic capillary hydrostatic pressure because their heart's not pumping, right? But again, there's not good forward flow. So GG cells are not being well perfused. So renin production is increased and you have the whole shebang, as I've mentioned already. Also cirrhosis, nephrotic syndrome, things that kill oncotic pressure in your bloodstream. Those things can also cause a person to develop hyponatremia. I don't know why I'm just kind of hammering on hyponatremia and its mechanisms. These are things they love to test on exams. But basically, right, those things kill your oncotic pressure. If you kill oncotic pressure, the problem is you're not going to have fluid in your vascular tree that can be sent back to the heart to pump it. So again, this is not a pump failure issue. This is a preload issue, right? Because again, you basically have like no good preload because you don't have oncotic pressure to hold fluid within your vascular tree. So the same issue kind of crops up. You don't send enough blood to the heart. The heart's not pumping out much. GG cells are not being well perfused. You make a ton of renin, make a ton of aldosterone and ADH, and then boom, that sets you up for disaster, right? So I'll certainly know those things for your exams, right? And again, when people are hyponatremic, most of their symptoms tend to be neurologic, right? So like, you know, cerebral edema, you know, because hyponatremia causes cerebral edema, right? They'll have headache, they can have seizures, especially when their sodium is around like the 120s or lower, right? You know, they will have like decreased level of consciousness, right? Their reflexes may not be good. Many people don't give sodium credit, but when you have hyponatremia, you're going to have a hyporeflexia actually, right? So just kind of keep that at the back of your mind for exams, right? And the way we treat hyponatremia just really depends on the mechanism, right? So if a person has like hypovolemic hyponatremia, right? Again, typically that's going to be from like GI, renal, you know, skin losses, blood fluid loss. Just give them normal saline, right? But for euvolemic hyponatremia, typically that's going to be in the setting of SIDH, right? Or a person that is hypothyroid. Just basically restrict fluids. That's what you should do. Restrict fluids, right? Fix the underlying cause, right? If they have SIDH, fix it, like what's causing it. If they have hypothyroidism, give them thyroid hormone, for example, right? And then hypervolemic, right? Again, it depends on the underlying cause, right? But typically, hypervolemic is going to be from the CHF person, the cirrhotic person, the nephrotic syndrome person, right? Those people, they look volume overloaded on exams, right? So in those people, restrict fluids, restrict sodium, right? If they have really bad edema, like a CHF patient, go ahead and give them a loop diuretic, right? And again, if a person has hypernatremia that is so severe that they have like seizures or they have a coma, then you want to definitely consider giving those people hypertonic saline. But again, remember, when you're trying to raise a person's sodium, just like I said, on the way down, be careful. On the way up, be careful too, right? You don't want to raise a person's sodium by more than like 8 millimoles per liter, right? So like 8 millimolar basically in 24 hours, right? So you don't want to make it rise by more than 0.25 millimoles per liter per hour maximum, right? Because again, if you raise a person's sodium too fast, they can develop osmotic demyelination syndrome, right? Many of us know this as a central pontine myelinolysis, right? There's this famous mnemonic, I'm sure many of you have learned over the years, that from low to high, the pons will die, and from high to low, the brain will blow, right? So if you fix hyponatremia too quickly, pons gone. If you fix hypernatremia too quickly, brain explodes, right? So just be careful about those things. And just a quick shout out, if you're a person that loves the way I teach and integrate concepts, you're going to absolutely love my classes. This month of September, I have a test taking strategies class. I have a biostatistics class. I have a social sciences and ethics class. These three classes are for step 1 to 3. And then I have a last minute review and I have a 20-hour step 2, step 3 class. These last two classes are for step 2, STK, and step 3, respectively, right? And then I also offer one-on-one tutoring and I offer help with ERAS applications, personal statement editing, and things like that. And then also, I have a new book that I wrote recently. It's called Unusual Career Options for Physicians. If you look for my name in Amazon, it's a Kindle book. It's actually a really nice book, and you can also buy a paperback version. But it kind of tells you about like the different side gigs available to physicians, or like, let's say, for example, you don't match, or you left residency or whatever. I give very practical steps and tips in that book. And then also check out Divine InterventionLifeLessons.com. Every week I post a podcast where, from a biblical perspective, I address a life lesson. Again, many people have listened to those and found those to be helpful. All right. So how about, what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that this patient Just completed a marathon like 6 hours ago. And then the person has been having a lot of nausea, right? Having like very serious palpitations. And then they show you an EKG and you notice that, wow, the QRS complexes are very wide, right? In fact, in some leads, you see like almost like a sinusoidal wave. When you see stuff like this, what should you be thinking about? I'd really hope you're saying that, wow, Divine, it sounds like this person has a really nasty hyperkalemia, right? Really nasty hyperkalemia, right? So what are the things that can kind of get you towards hyperkalemia land on your exams? It can be things like rhabdomyolysis, which this person has, right? This marathon runner, right? They've kind of broken down a lot of their muscles. You break down a lot of muscles. Remember, potassium is an intracellular ion. And why is potassium an intracellular ion? Well, it's because of the activity of the sodium-potassium ATPase pump, right? That pump gets 3 sodiums out of cells and 2 potassiums into cells. So if you're getting a lot of potassium into cells, potassium is going to be an intracellular ion, right? So if for whatever reason you explode a lot of muscle cells, right, that can cause you to have hyperkalemia. And again, guys, you want to be careful, right? Basically, whenever a lot of cells explode all at once, that will cause hyperkalemia because potassium is an intracellular ion in many cells. So just like I talked about rhabdomyolysis, I could also make up a vignette on a person that has tumor lysis syndrome, right? That can also cause hyperkalemia. I could also make up a vignette on a person that has like profound red blood cell hemolysis. That can also cause hyperkalemia, right? So just going to keep that at the back of your mind for exams. And also if you just have an insulin deficiency for whatever reason, right? Because remember, one of the jobs of insulin is to stimulate the activity of the sodium potassium ATPase pump, right? So if it's not well stimulated, you will not be taking 2 potassiums into cells. So potassium is going to hang out on the outside of the cell. That can cause a person to have hyperkalemia, right? And also, if they give you a question about a person that misses dialysis and has EKG abnormalities, it's hyperkalemia that's the cause, right? Because again, if you miss dialysis, right? Again, remember, your kidneys are one of the primary potassium excretory organs, your kidneys and your GI tract, but your kidneys especially. So you only have to miss like 2 sessions or there, 1 or 2 sessions of dialysis, and you can develop a florid hyperkalemia, right? So just going to keep that at the back of your mind. Or a person develops acute renal failure for whatever reason, that can also cause them to have hyperkalemia. I remember metabolic acidosis can also cause hyperkalemia, right? Because remember, many cells have this hydrogen potassium antiporter, right? So if you have a lot of hydrogen ions in your serum because you're acidotic, your body's going to try to reduce your serum acidity by getting some hydrogen ions into cells, right? And then bringing potassium ions out. That can cause a person to have hyperkalemia, right? And then remember, when you have potassium polypharmacy, right? So you're combining many different medications that can cause hyperkalemia together, that can cause you to have hyperkalemia, right? So like, for example, a person is taking like ACE inhibitors and ARBs at the same time, that can cause a person to have hyperkalemia, right? So keep that at the back of your mind for exams, right? So again, typically when a person has hyperkalemia, they're going to be nauseous, they're going to be having palpitations, right? They'll have like hyporeflexia as well, right? What was the other thing that causes hyporeflexia we've talked about today? We said hyponatremia, right? Hyponatremia, but hyperkalemia can also cause hyporeflexia as well, right? So, you know, they'll have palpitations, they can have like arrhythmias, right? Topic T waves, right? White QRS complexes, sinusoidal wave EKGs, right? Especially when your potassium is really, really bad, right? So remember, when a person has hyperkalemia, what do we do, right? Typically, you're going to give them calcium gluconate to protect the heart, right? To stabilize the myocardium, right? And then you can try to shift potassium into cells, right? Basically, try to stimulate the sodium potassium ATPase pump. Well, how could you do that? You could give the person insulin and dextrose, right? You don't want to give them just insulin because you don't want to create hypoglycemia that can kill them too, right? So you want to give them insulin plus dextrose. That's going to stimulate the sodium potassium pump, which again, as I said, brings 3 sodiums out of cells, puts 2 potassiums into cells. You can give albuterol, right? Albuterol is a beta 2 agonist, but it also stimulates the sodium potassium ATPase pump, right? You can give a person sodium bicarbonate, right? Because sodium bicarb, right, is going to make you basic instead of acidic. And if you become basic, then there's going to be an impetus for hydrogen ions to be drawn out of your intracellular environment into the bloodstream. And as hydrogen ions are drawn out, potassium ions will go in, right? That can lower your serum potassium levels, right? You can also just do dialysis as well. You can use potassium. You can use diuretics like furosemide, right? Remember, diuretics cause hypokalemia, so you're basically taking advantage of that side effect, right? So again, remember, with hyperkalemia, it's all in the EKGs, right? They can have like very high risk of arrhythmias, right? That's something you want to definitely keep at the back of your mind for exams, right? Very high risk of arrhythmias, right? They can have these, again, tall-peaked, you know, narrow T waves, right? Their P waves can be smaller, right? PR intervals can be prolonged. QRS can be widened. Sine wave EKG, right? Hyperkalemia, believe it or not, can cause AV blocks, can cause VFib. It can cause so many problems, right? But again, remember the key ones, tall-peaked T waves, white QRS, sine wave EKGs, right? See that, think of hyperkalemia. All right. Now, what if they give you a question about a person that has, had a very severe asthma exacerbation, has been on continuous nebulizer therapy, and then you're told that an EKG shows a QT prolongation? What should you be thinking about here? I'd really hope you're thinking that, man, Divine, it sounds like this person has hypokalemia, right? Again, hypokalemia can prolong the QT. And why does this person have hypokalemia? Well, think back to what this person has. This person has a severe asthma exacerbation. So probably getting a lot of beta 2 agonist therapy, right? Like albuterol. And again, remember, albuterol, if you take it sufficiently for sufficiently long, again, you have stimulation of your sodium potassium ATPase pump. And if that happens, you're going to, again, get three sodiums out of cells and two potassiums into cells. That can cause a person to have hypokalemia, right? Remember other things that can cause hypokalemia if you have like just chronic volume loss for whatever reason. So say for example, like you're an eating disorder patient, right? Like an anorexic or a bulimic, right? Those people are like pooping, peeing a lot, you know, because they're taking diuretics or laxatives, or they're vomiting, right? Again, you're volume depleted. When you're volume depleted, you're not going to perfuse your kidneys very well. You're not going to perfuse your GG cells very well, right? So renin is going to be produced in high amounts. You're going to make a ton of aldosterone. Remember, one of the jobs of aldosterone is to cause you to excrete potassium in your urine. If you excrete a lot of potassium in your urine, that's going to cause you to have hypokalemia, right? Also remember, if you're taking a ton of insulin, right, that can also cause you to have hypokalemia, right? Because again, insulin stimulates that sodium potassium ATPase pump, right? People on diuretics, right, they can have a dangerous hypokalemia. People on thiazides, people on loops, because again, those things cause volume depletion, right? If you have a metabolic alkalosis, that can also cause hypokalemia, right? Because again, if you have metabolic alkalosis, that's going to pull hydrogen ions out of cells, and then potassium ions are going to go in reverse. Remember that hydrogen potassium antipodal I talked about earlier on, right? So what are the classic symptoms people will have when they have hypokalemia? They're going to be nauseous, they're going to be vomiting, right? They're going to have muscle cramps. Think, when you see a lot of muscle problems, think hypokalemia on your exams, right? When you see a lot of muscle problems, I will strongly encourage you to think of hypokalemia on your exams, right? So muscle problems, they can have constipation, they can have arrhythmias, right? Because again, remember, when you have hypokalemia, that can cause a QT prolongation. Sorry, I had to sip some water there. Sometimes talking this faster kind of makes you dehydrated. I don't want to develop a hypokalemia, if you may. Okay, just kidding. All right, so they can be constipated, right? They can have arrhythmias and all these problems, right? So what do you usually do for hypokalemia? You can give them IV potassium, right? You can give them IV potassium chloride. Just be careful though, you don't want to stop their hearts, because I'm pretty sure like lethal injections contain very concentrated amounts of potassium chloride. So just be careful. I've actually heard like a medical malpractice thing with this, right? So it's just something you want to keep at the back of your mind for exams. I'm not going to go into that. I'm not going to be talking about lethal injections here. There are certain things that are above my pay grade, so I'm gonna skip that, right? So remember, on an EKG, right, again, you're gonna see U waves, right? In fact, U waves are probably like the most consistent EKG association with hypokalemia, believe it or not, right? Again, they'll have like flattened, you know, inverted T waves. They'll have prolonged QT, right? And again, remember, just one sneaky thing I want to throw in here. When you're trying to fix a person's potassium, just make sure that their magnesium is not out of whack too, right? Because if you're trying to fix a person's potassium and their magnesium is very out of whack, that potassium replenishment is not gonna work, right? So just gonna keep that at the back of your mind for exams, right? And then what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that this patient, has a that his dad died of medullary thyroid cancer, right? And then you're told that this patient comes into the hospital because, you know, they've been having a lot of abdominal pain, right? They've been having a lot of flank pain, right? They have a lot of bone pain, right? And they tell you that this person in this question has kind of been acting a little altered, you know, acting psychotic. What should you be thinking about here? I'd really hope you're thinking about MEN2A, right? You're like, Divine, seriously? How did you get there? Well, let's explain, right? Calm down, right? So that died of medullary thyroid cancer, right? So that kind of rules out MEN1. Remember, medullary thyroid cancer is not found in MEN1, right? Remember in MEN1, right, parapan pit, so they have primary hyperparathyroidism, they have a pituitary adenomas, and then they have a pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors like gastrinomas, insulinomas, and things like that, right? But I'm saying MEN2A because the person has medullary thyroid cancer. Remember, it's the MEN2s that cause medullary thyroid cancer, but which MEN2 is associated with primary hyperparathyroidism? It's going to be MEN2A. Remember, MEN2A, they have primary hyperparathyroidism, they have medullary thyroid cancer, right? And they can also have like a pheochromocytomas, right? So that's something you want to keep at the back of your mind for exams, right? So this person has primary hyperparathyroidism, right? So that caused hypercalcemia, right? Because remember, PTH, one of its jobs is to cause you to reabsorb more calcium from your kidneys. That can cause hypercalcemia, right? So hyperparathyroidism, you know, is a very big cause of hypercalcemia, right? Malignancy, right? In fact, those two things alone account for like 90% of cases of hypercalcemia, right? And then remember, thiazides can also cause hypercalcemia. Remember, lithium can also cause hypercalcemia, right? So keep those things at the back of your mind for exams, right? And again, classic signs of hypercalcemia, right? The stones, bones, groans, psychic overtones, right? So the psychic overtones are the psychiatric effects, right? Those are the moans, right? The bone pain, because again, if you have like hyperparathyroidism, you're going to be chewing up your bone with osteoclasts. That's going to cause you to have bone pain, right? GI is going to be groans, right? Remember, hypercalcemia can cause like constipation and all these problems, right? So how do you treat a hypercalcemia that is symptomatic? Like we see in this person, the first thing you want to do on your exams is give normal saline, right? And again, I don't know, for whatever reason, sometimes on the USMLEs, instead of using the term normal saline, they'll just call it isotonic saline, right? They'll just call it isotonic saline. So you're just going to keep that in mind for tests, right? But basically, these people need normal saline, right? Because again, remember, hypercalcemia causes nephrogenic diabetes insipidus. Whenever your serum calcium levels are very high, remember, calcium is an ion we find a lot in the kidneys. It actually inhibits the second messenger system of the ADH receptor, right? So you're going to have a nephrogenic diabetes insipidus, right? So this is why most times when people have hypercalcemia that is symptomatic, they're going to have like profound volume depletion, right? So go ahead and give those people normal saline, right? You can also give them IV bisphosphonates as well. You can do dialysis. You can do chelation with like EDTA, right? But again, typically normal saline is usually about as far as they go on the exams, right? Just kind of keep that in mind, right? So again, saline hydration, right? They may use the answer choice that says normal saline, or they may use the term isotonic saline, or they may use the term saline hydration. All right. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient that just recently had a resection of papillary thyroid cancer, right? You know, the person had the resection like 12 hours ago. The person is in the ICU recovering from the surgery, but then you're told that the person has been having a lot of laryngospasm, right? Person is having a lot of hyperreflexia, right? So notice here, it's hyperreflexia. Remember, we talked about hyporeflexia or areflexia with hyponatremia and hyperkalemia, and we talked about muscle issues with hypokalemia, right? So hyperkalemia, hyponatremia cause decrease in reflexes. Hypokalemia causes muscle cramps, muscle problems, right? This electrolyte problem I'm going to talk about is going to cause hyperreflexia, right? You're told that the person has like tetanic muscle contractions, right? The person, you know, you tap the cheek, you have facial muscle spasms, that's the Svostek sign, or you put a blood pressure cuff or a tourniquet around your arm, and you have like carpopedal spasms, right? That's the Trousseau sign. When you see all these things, I hope you're thinking about hypocalcemia, right? And this person has hypocalcemia because of a iatrogenic cause, right? So remember, hypocalcemia causes a hyperreflexia, right? So from a iatrogenic cause, right? In fact, this is probably like the most common cause of primary hypoparathyroidism in the US, right? Basically a complication of thyroid surgery. I remember when I was in medical school at Hopkins, actually, I did an endocrine surgery or rotation, and this was something that we always worried about, right? So after we'll finish the thyroid cases, we always basically just kind of waited, twiddling our thumbs, while like a PTH or a calcium level was sent, right? Just to make sure that, hey, while we're taking out your thyroid or while we're doing thyroid surgery, we did not inadvertently devascularize your thyroid, your parathyroid glands, right? Because when PTH dips, your calcium is going to dip very quickly, believe it or not, right? So you know, iatrogenic causes, right? Remember, low albumin can also cause a person to have a hypocalcemia, right? If you have liver dysfunction, basically think of causes of vitamin D deficiency, right? Like, so if your liver doesn't work, you're not going to make calcidiol, right? Calcidiol is a 25-hydroxy vitamin D. It is made in the liver. That can cause you to have hypocalcemia, right? Or if you have like a renal dysfunction, then you have a vitamin D deficiency because you're not making calcitriol. Remember, the calcidiol that's made in the liver, 25-hydroxy vitamin D, goes to the kidneys, right, to be turned by 1-alpha-hydroxylase to calcitriol, which is 1,25-dihydroxy vitamin D. Again, if you have a vitamin D deficiency, you'll not reabsorb calcium from your gut, right? And then that's going to cause you to have a hypocalcemia. Also remember, primary hypoparathyroidism can also arise in a person that has DeGeorge syndrome, right? Remember, in DeGeorge syndrome, your third, your fourth pharyngeal pouches, they fail to form. And if they don't form, then you're not going to have PTH produced. And if you don't have PTH produced, so you won't have a thymus and a parathyroid, right? So you're not making PTH. If you don't make PTH, then that's going to lower your serum calcium levels, right? And also remember, autoimmune polyendocrine syndrome can also cause a hypoparathyroidism. You know, especially type 1, right? You have like Addison's disease, oral mucocutaneous candidiasis, and primary hypoparathyroidism. That's something you want to know for your exams, right? And just again, thyroid surgery as well, right? That's probably the thyroid surgery complication is probably the most common cause of primary hypoparathyroidism in the US, right? So again, don't forget your Svostek sign, your Trousseau sign. I've described those. Again, hyperreflexia, tetanic muscle contractions, right? I kind of remember that with the Svostek, the Trousseau signs, like your face and your hands are just kind of doing weird things, right? Think of that as related to the hyperreflexia, right? So how are we going to treat a hypocalcemia? Typically on your exams, you're going to treat it by, you know, giving acutely, right? Give them, you know, IV calcium gluconate, right? IV calcium gluconate. And again, remember, hypocalcemia can prolong your QT interval, right? It can prolong your QT interval, right? It can prolong your QT interval. It can prolong your QT interval. All right, so this was supposed to be a rapid review, but I really did get carried away on these electrolytes, because the thing is, whenever you're taking any USMLE exam, you just know that they're going to test electrolytes. It's just the truth, right? They're going to test electrolytes. It's going to show up on your exams. And if you don't know this stuff, you're going to get hosed very quickly, right? So hopefully you find this podcast to be helpful. Again, remember, I have this podcast on Apple, Google, and Spotify. Check out my YouTube channel. There's actually a bunch of really nice videos I've posted recently and worksheets, actually. So check those out. And again, please share this with your friends. And interested in any of my classes, shoot me an email, divineinterventionpodcasts@gmail.com. Or you can just email me directly from my website, divineinterventionpodcast.com. All right, so have a wonderful day. God bless you. I'll see you, God willing, episode, I guess, 670. Wow. Can't wait to clock 700, right? So I'll see you in episode 670. But have a wonderful day. God bless you, and bye for now. Thank you.